In early 2009, as our legal defense bills piled up, Todd and I retreated to my quiet bedroom office and sat down for a sobering look at our finances. By then, we were faced with attorney's bills that would grow to more than $500,000, a lot more than my total salary for all the time I'd served as governor. Then Meg broke the news that a large chunk of those bills, nearly $50,000, was courtesy of the campaign. It was our portion of the bills for having been vetted. I had no idea, nor was I ever told, that we would have to pay personally to go through the VP selection process. If I had, I would have kept my answer shorter. Meg and my attorney, Tom Van Fine, made polite inquiries with the RNC and the remnants of headquarters to see whether the McCain campaign could help with these expenses. The word came back from on high. If we had won the election, they would have paid. But we lost, so the responsibility was mine. Looking on the bright side, though, if anyone questions whether I was properly vetted, at least now I can tell them, yes, and I have the bill to prove it. As a number of ethics complaints and lawsuits mounted, I remembered the observations of the left-wing radical-turned-conservative activist David Horowitz in his treatise, The Art of Political War. I'd been following Horowitz's work ever since I met him a decade earlier at an Alaska GOP convention at which we both spoke. His book explained the stark difference between the left's expert use of weapons of political warfare and the right's high-minded but ineffective approach. One of the left's favorite weapons is frivolous ethics complaints. In my case, one by one, every ethics charge filed against me and my staff was tossed out, but there was one that was settled with a finding of no wrongdoing. It concerned first family travel. Since we live in a huge state with few roads linking rural communities, flying to another city usually isn't just a day trip. Before, when I'd travel on the road system for a state function, any of the kids who were not tied up with school or a sport could just jump into the truck and off we'd go. When we had to fly somewhere for a first family event, the state would pay for it. Otherwise, I would pay for the kids out of my own pocket. Sometimes we could hop on the state's prison transport plane, the King Air, and zip somewhere to attend one of the many first family events we were constantly being invited to. It wasn't as though they were bumping anyone. The seats were empty, and it was usually only Piper displacing 40 pounds of air on this old state aircraft. I loved traveling with the kids because they needed me and I needed them. They got to share in some of the joys of public service and to see what hard work it is. Often, constituents were happier to see, say, Todd at an outdoor Alaskana event or Trig at a senior citizens event than they were to see me. However, a complaint was filed about my kids' travel. It targeted trips that appeared to have questionable benefits to the state. Trips such as Piper's travel to wave the starting flag at one year's Iron Dog race, though apparently her travel to two other Iron Dog races was fine. Go figure. All of my kids' travel requests had been authorized by the Department of Administration and approved by the ethics supervisors who had worked for previous administrations on both sides of the aisle. We had disclosed and announced all of our travel. Nothing was hidden. And here's the kicker. I had spent less on travel and personal expenses than my last two predecessors, despite having a much larger family. The personnel board investigator for this complaint was a Democrat, and though he had been fair to my administration in the past, the word was that he was feeling some pressure not to let us off. Still, he admitted that the travel guidelines were vague and circular, and that I had correctly followed the law and the historical precedent established by past governors in their family travel. However, because the travel guidelines were so vague, he asked me if I would hold myself to a future law that could one day be written to establish cleaner travel guidelines. I'm always in favor of holding myself to a higher standard. I agreed. He reviewed my kids' trips and presented me with a list of the ones he found questionable according to the new and as yet unbinding guidelines he established for judging their benefit to the state. He then offered me two options to settle the case. I could reimburse the state for the 8 or 9 trips, or I could present my case to the personnel board and wait for the board to provide clearer guidelines or tell my administration what to do. I saw the second option as an utter waste of state time and public resources. The proceedings would be a major distraction and would only prolong the complaint process that was obviously out of control. Besides, it wasn't fair to have yet another complaint distract us from doing our job and distract Alaskans from the progress being made for the state. I signed a settlement that stated clearly that I had not violated any law, travel regulation, or protocol. I agreed to reimburse the state for the trips in question, even though they were first family functions that the kids were invited to. My staff had all the emails and invitations proving this. One of the trips I reimbursed never actually took place. It was the one listed as Bristol, travel to attend Valley Performing Arts, Beauty and the Beast, opening night. I was pretty sure she hadn't attended the play, and later I confirmed with her that she hadn't, but I reimbursed the state for it anyway because my Department of Law told me to just sign the settlement and get it over with, even though I knew how the media would spin it. And spin they did. The result is that instead of reporting that an independent board of review found me not guilty of any wrongdoing and that all the ethics charges filed against me have been dismissed, the media made statements like, Governor Palin has been dogged by ethics complaints, most of which have been dismissed. Most of which. Now an asterisk will forever accompany the issue because of this one settlement, although the fact is, all have been dismissed. Indeed, the resolution of the travel issue expressly concluded that no rule was violated and that the law needs to be rewritten because even lawyers could not explain what it said. Despite the attacks, Todd encouraged me. It's still best for the state that you're there. The people who are ticked off just cannot stand that with all the darts and arrows they throw, your team is still making progress. Do you kind of get a kick out of that aspect of all this? He grinned. Well, what a perspective, I said, not grinning. Hey, just keep reminding me of Grandpa Sharon's favorite Latin tag, illegitimi non carborundum, which, loosely translated, means don't let the bastards get you down. It was easy to take Grandpa's advice when it concerned my own hide, but the attacks on my family, those cut deep. I would only ask this of others. Imagine if your family were the subject of relentless attention from a hostile press. Surely there is at least one person or incident the press could seize on to embarrass your loved ones. Perhaps there is a messy divorce, or even an adored child whom you are proud of but who maybe made a mistake and is now taking responsibility and doing so with quiet grace and hard work. If your extended family doesn't fit that description, count your blessings. I've never met anyone like you. The questions for me became, how do I respond to attacks on my children? Do I respond? Do I ignore them? And if I ignore them, will that encourage more or allow the cheapening of our national discourse to go unchallenged? I still don't know the answer, but I responded as any mother would, with that Mama Grizzly thing again. Bristol was criticized from all sides as a hypocrite because she took up the cause of helping prevent teen pregnancy. Critics couldn't understand how she could love her precious son, Tripp, with all her heart and still wish that he had been born 10 years later. She wanted teens to know that though they had choices to make about contraception, the only surefire way of preventing pregnancy is not to have sex. This pragmatic position was attacked by both the right and the left. The left because abstinence seems to be a dirty word, and the right because even mentioning the word contraception sends a mixed message. Bristol wasn't trying to draft a national sex ed policy. She just wanted to help her peers. She simply told teens what she has told her sisters. Don't make the same mistake I did. Wait. She graduated from high school on time with great grades while raising her son and working two part-time jobs to pay for his diapers and formula, and then immediately started college classes. You don't read about any of this positive progress in the tabloids and scandal rags, though. Bristol wasn't the only target. Using partisan bloggers as their primary sources, some reporters questioned Track's enlistment, suggesting that he had joined the Army because he was hiding from the law. Also, unbelievably, hurtful attacks were directed at Trigg. On the internet, a fake Planned Parenthood ad showed a photo of me holding Trigg. In one corner, there was a coat hanger, and in the other, a slogan, "Better luck next time." What kind of person creates something like that? maybe the same kind who had photoshopped distorted images over Trigg's pretty face in order to make him look monstrous. The person who did this proudly displayed it on her website. She was also the official Alaskan blogger for the Democratic National Committee during the 2008 election. It was reported nationally that a Manhattan federal judge named Naomi Reese Buchwald blasted me for bringing Trigg on stage during the campaign. That kid was used as a prop, and that to me as a parent blew my mind, she said. Apparently she missed it when the Obamas appeared on stage with their lovely daughters, or the Bidens, or the McCains, or most every other public servant and parent in living memory. Imagine if I hadn't been a proud mom. Those same individuals would have said I was ashamed of Trigg. I'm a mom. He's my baby. Who is this woman to say I cannot hold my baby in public? No one told me that running for office means a woman candidate has to switch off her maternal instincts and hide her children from view. If that's required, then count me out. Let's debate ideas. Let's argue about legislation and policy. Let's talk about political philosophy. But leave my children alone. At some point, you have to say enough. You have to pick your battle. Pick your hilltop and hold the position of your own choosing. My state was being shaken by one partisan earthquake after another. Every time we found steady ground, another avalanche of FOIAs, ethics complaints, and lawsuits crashed down. My team had been targeted for destruction because of who the team leader was. I began to think it was time to pass the ball. And after many months of consideration and prayer, a phone call from the other side of the world helped me clarify it all at last. This isn't good, Mom, Track told me from a desert outpost 6,000 miles away. I just saw another dumbass expert on TV telling the world who he thinks we are. A year earlier, if Track had said that to me, I would have argued with him and said, come on, it's not that bad. But for the first time, he sounded tired, and I could tell he wasn't in the mood to be lectured. This time, I heard him out. I know you, Mom. You want to protect us. You want to say, screw this, I won't put my family through this. Track did know me. But are you going to let those idiots run you off? You can't tap out. He talked about watching his sister be humiliated on national television as her former boyfriend went on his fact-free kiss-and-tell media tour. Track knew the kid was making things up. When he started giving example after example of all he had watched and read, I interrupted. Those are political potshots, son, I reminded him, thinking of my recent trip to the medical facility in Lansdell. The shots that really hurt are felt by people losing their livelihoods, losing a loved one in battle. He interrupted me. That's my point, Mom. Then he hushed his voice because there were always fellow soldiers around. Don't let the jerks get you down. His view was that you don't quit. You don't violate your contract. There is pain. You push through it. You stick it out. Then he brought it home. No dishonorable discharge. You only leave if it's honorable. That means you move up to something more worthy. Then it was my turn. I asked him if he thought protecting Trigg and his sisters was more worthy. I asked if fighting through the bull so that I could reveal truth and fight for what is right for our state and our country was more worthy. I asked if breaking free of the bureaucratic shackles that were now paralyzing our state was worthy. I finally said out loud what I knew I had to do. I'm not a quitter, Track, I finished. I'm going to fight, and that's the point. By the end of the conversation, Track understood more. He knew this was one of the most important decisions I would ever make, and he also knew that I knew what I was talking about. I hear you, Mom, he finally said. I'm praying for you. Fast about it for a day, I said. Eat nothing for a whole day? Holy crap! Okay, forget fasting food, I conceded. Fast from cussing for a day, then. Hell no, impossible over here. Next. He agreed to give up chew for a day. That was a big darn deal. I remembered again the advice of my dear friend Curtis Menard. He said, in politics, you're either eating well or sleeping well. Was I sleeping well, knowing that I was incapable of serving my state effectively, that I had become an obstacle to progress because I was the target of out-of-control obstructionists? No, I wasn't sleeping well at all. A politician is supposed to be a public servant, but in our current understanding, a politician would have just gone with the flow, collected the paycheck, padded the resume, and finished the term as a lame duck. But that's not what a public servant would do. How would a lame duck session benefit Alaskans? How would millions more in FOIAs and ethics complaints and lawsuits benefit Alaskans? I prayed hard because I knew that if I resigned, it might very well end any future political career. But then I thought, this is what's wrong with our political system. Too many politicians only consider their next career move. They don't put the people they are serving first. In the end, I decided, politically speaking, if I die, I die. I had to do the right thing. It might be the end of my career, but it wouldn't be the end of my work to make a difference. No one can make me sit down and shut up. I don't need a title to affect positive change. On July 3, 2009, I announced our decision in a speech from my backyard, with my cabinet members lined up alongside the Parnell family on one side and my family on the other. It was a gorgeous summer day, and the waters of Lake Lucille shimmered behind me. I was thankful to have my family with me, because they had been there 4 years before, on Alaska Day, to begin this journey. Most of them had, anyway. Trig cuddled in Piper's arms, cooing and squirming until finally being handed off to his Aunt Heather, then to his Aunt Molly, as his 14-month-old talking grew louder during the press event. Trip slept in Uncle Chuck's arms. As cameras rolled, I announced my conclusion that it was best for Alaska if I stepped aside. We will be in the capable hands of our Lieutenant Governor, Sean Parnell, and it is my promise to you that I will always be standing by, ready to assist. We have a good, positive agenda for Alaska. In the words of General MacArthur, we are not retreating, we are advancing in another direction. Or, as my dad later put it, Sarah's not retreating, she's reloading. I wanted to leave no doubt that I wasn't running from political shots. In my inaugural address, I had asked Alaskans to hold me accountable, but I wanted to be held accountable for doing my job. I wanted to be challenged to serve the state better, not have to prove that I'm Trig Palin's mom. We had invited only local press, and one station sent its satellite truck out from Anchorage. I figured it must be quite a slow news day to warrant that. The station blasted my speech across the country. Though we knew my announcement would make news, we did not expect the wall-to-wall national coverage that exploded over the next week. As Chris, my chief of staff Mike Nysick, and family members stood in my kitchen, my brother turned up the television just to get a read on what kind of bizarre theories the press was cranking out this time. Before long, we told him just turn off the news, and we just had to say it. What a bunch of buffoons. I knew resigning was the right thing to do, the same way I had known it was right to run for mayor, right to take on the party at the AOGCC, and right to run for governor, and right to say yes to John McCain. I knew we had just done the right thing for Alaska. We were now going to get to fight for what is right for our state and our country. I was at peace and confident in my decision. I felt a renewed sense of excitement and freedom. So, of course, we ate cake. Since leaving office, I've frequently been asked, what does Sarah Palin stand for? What's your vision for the future? I welcome the opportunity to share it. Keep in mind, I tell my parents the greatest gift they ever gave me, besides building a foundation of love for family and for healthy competition, was an upbringing in Alaska. The pioneering spirit of the last frontier has shaped me. I am an independent person who had the good fortune to come of age in the era of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. I am a registered Republican because the planks in that party's platform are stronger than any others upon which to build Alaska and America. I disagree with some of the characters in the party machine, but the GOP stands for principles that will strengthen and secure the country if they are applied. I'm not obsessively partisan, though, and I don't blame people who dislike political labels even more than I do. My husband, for example, isn't registered with any party, for sound reasons, having been an eyewitness to the idiosyncrasies of party machines. I also don't like the narrow stereotypes of either the conservative or liberal label, but until we change the lingo, call me a common-sense conservative. What does it mean to be a common-sense conservative? At its most basic level, conservatism is a respect for history and tradition, including traditional moral principles. I do not believe I am more moral, certainly no better, than anyone else, and conservatives who act holier than thou turn my stomach. So do some elite liberals. But I do believe in a few timeless and unchanging truths, and chief among those is that man has fallen. The world is not perfect, and politicians will never make it so. This, above all, is what informs my pragmatic approach to politics. I am a conservative because I deal with the world as it is, complicated and beautiful, tragic and hopeful. I am a conservative because I believe in the rights and the responsibilities and the inherent dignity of the individual. In his book, A Conflict of Visions, Thomas Sowell explains underlying assumptions or visions that shape our opinions and the way we approach social and political issues. He identifies two separate visions, the unconstrained and the constrained. People who adhere to the unconstrained vision, the label applied to them as liberal or left-wing, believe that human nature is changeable, therefore perfectible, and that society's problems can all be solved if only the poor, ignorant, disorganized public is told what to do and rational plans are enacted. And who better to make those plans than an elite bureaucracy pulling the strings and organizing society according to their master blueprint? No one can doubt that our current leaders in Washington subscribe to this unconstrained vision. Conservatives believe in the constrained political vision because we know that human nature is flawed and that there are limitations to what can be done in Washington to fix society's problems. Common sense conservatives deal with human nature as it is, with its unavoidable weaknesses and its potential for goodness. We see the world as it is, imperfect, but filled with beauty. We hope for the best. We believe people can change for the better. But we do not ignore history's lessons and waste time chasing utopian pipe dreams. We do not trust utopian promises from politicians. The role of government is not to perfect us, but to protect us, to protect our inalienable rights. The role of government in a civil society is to protect the individual and to establish a social contract so that we can live together in peace. We are currently in the midst of an economic crisis, and the recovery is slow in coming. But I do have fundamental faith in the American entrepreneurial spirit. We go through booms and busts, and America comes out stronger. Just as wildfires in Alaska burn away deadfall to make way for new growth, so too does the business cycle undergo a process of creative destruction. We let some dying businesses fail as new businesses emerge. The horse and buggy gradually disappeared after Henry Ford introduced an affordable automobile. In my lifetime, we've gone from companies in the business of making LPs to 8-tracks, to cassette tapes, to compact discs, to MP3s. My kids finally got me to retire the portable CD player I lugged around while jogging. I now carry an iPod, and I can't wait to see what comes next. The marketplace changes. Often it's not easy for politicians to explain to their constituents this process of creative destruction with its booms and its busts, because more and more politicians prefer pandering instead. They complicate simple and sober truths and make vague promises to get elected. It's easy to promise free medical care and a chicken in every pot. It's more difficult to explain how we're going to pay for it all and to explain why social programs that were supposed to help the poor have ended up hurting them, becoming unsustainable financial liabilities for all of us. Ronald Reagan was the last president to really explain this to us. Somewhere along the way, these clear principles got lost. People look at the Republican Party today, the supposedly conservative party, and say, "What happened to the Reagan legacy?" And we deserve that criticism. The national GOP gambled away the progress of the Reagan years. Perhaps they meant well, but it looked to me as if they thought they could achieve a permanent majority by compromising their principles. In the end, they lost both. You can't claim to be a fiscal conservative and then institute massive new spending programs without even attempting to reduce government in other areas. President Reagan used to speak of reducing the federal government. Now some Republicans barely bat an eyelash when helping create whole new federal bureaucracies. Today, if you ask, Why exactly do we need that federal program? Can't we do without it? People will look at you as if you're from outer space, or perhaps from Alaska. Many people had stopped questioning this federal government growth until we elected an administration that is growing government at a rate unprecedented in our history. This change has awakened the curiosity and concern of all Americans. Now people are asking, why do we continue to add to our skyrocketing debt? How will our children pay these bills? We are already in a very deep hole. When will we stop digging? We have allowed the left, with its unconstrained vision, to convince us that America's current woes were caused by too little government involvement and regulation, and that the only way to fix our problems is for bureaucracy to regulate more, to stifle more freedoms, and to force itself even deeper into the private sector. This is nonsense. We got into this economic mess because of misplaced government interference in the first place. The mortgage crisis that triggered the collapse of our financial markets was rooted in a well-meaning but wrong-headed desire to increase home ownership among people who could not yet afford to own a home. Politicians on the right and left wanted to take credit for an increase in middle-class home ownership. But the rules of the marketplace are just as constraining as human nature. Government cannot force financial institutions to give loans to people who can't afford to pay them back, and then expect that somehow things will all magically work out. Sooner or later, reality catches up with us. Within 6 months of taking office, President Obama put the United States on track to double its already staggering national deficit. The new debt, which will burden future generations, is immoral, and all of it in the name of fixing an economy broken by too much debt in the first place. Servicing the $11.5 trillion debt is a huge annual expenditure in the federal budget. Those who hold our debt, including foreign countries like China and Saudi Arabia, must be paid first. Last year, we spent more than $400 billion to service our debt. At this rate, by 2019, that number is expected to be $1 trillion. Our overspending today could destroy our children's future. Is that what the president meant by change? Where is all of this money going to come from? It can come from only three places. Government borrows it, government prints it, or government taxes the people for it. So far, the administration has done the first two. We've borrowed massive sums from foreign countries. And we've also simply printed money. Economists call this practice monetizing the debt. And it's not something we hear much about. Higher taxes won't be far behind. Our parents were right when they told us that money doesn't grow on trees. There are consequences to these massive spending plans, and we will be feeling them soon. Is that what the president meant by change? Washington is not done with its spending spree yet. Congress is talking about additional stimulus packages and bailouts. But we tried growing government to save the economy back in the 1930s, and it didn't work then either. Massive government spending programs and protectionist economic policies actually helped turn a recession into the Great Depression. New Deal-like spending plans aren't the only blast from the past we see today. With the government takeover of parts of the banking industry and the auto industry, we see the return of corporatism, government collusion, and co-option of big business. No one person is smart enough to control and predict markets. The free market is just that, free to rise or fall, shrink or expand, based on conditions that are often outside of human control. Government interference in market cycles is just as dangerous as government-directed programs that encourage permanent dependency. In both cases, the rewards for responsible behavior and the penalties for irresponsible behavior are removed by the state. This is the lesson I tried to convey to Bristol when we discussed her plans for the future. It may look to her now that the rewards for her responsible behavior and sacrifices as a hard-working single parent will be a long time coming, but in time they will. Our massive interventions in the economy today haven't fixed anything. Instead, we're rewarding a few large firms for being irresponsible. We've told them they're too big to fail. We've told them that the bigger they are and the more trouble they get themselves into, the more likely the government will be to bail them out. Sorry, little guys. Bruce's Muldoon Chevron isn't big enough to save. Uncle Kurt, you're on your own. The lesson in all of this is that we can't abandon free market principles in order to save the free market. It doesn't work that way. The cure only makes the disease worse. One such cure, Washington's misguided cap-and-trade plan. But let's call it what it is, a cap-and-tax program. Environmentalists' plan to reduce pollution is to tax businesses according to how much pollution they produce. Industries that emit more pollutants would have to pay more in taxes. Businesses that reduce emissions and thereby avoid all or part of the cap and tax hits could trade or sell their government credits to other companies. There are big problems with this. We have the highest unemployment rate in 25 years, and it's still rising. American jobs in every industry will be threatened by the rising cost of doing business under cap and trade. The cost of farming, for example, will certainly increase, driving down farm incomes while driving up grocery prices. The cost of manufacturing, warehousing, and transportation will also rise. We'll all feel the effects of this misguided plan to buy and sell pollution. The president has already admitted that the policy he seeks will cause our electricity bills to skyrocket. Sadly, those hit hardest will be those who are already struggling to make ends meet. So much for the campaign promise not to raise taxes on anyone making less than $250,000 a year. This is a tax on everyone. Is this what the president meant by change? As more and more Americans understand that cap and trade is an environmentalist Ponzi scheme in which only the government benefits, they will refuse to tolerate it. They will make their voices heard at the ballot box, and any lawmaker who supports destructive legislation like this will soon be turned out of office. That's what we mean by change. Our nation is facing great challenges, but I'm optimistic, and I know there is a way forward. Ronald Reagan faced an even worse recession. He showed us how to get out of one. If you want real job growth, cut capital gains taxes and slay the death tax once and for all. And if we really want to help the poor and middle class get through this recession, how about cutting their payroll taxes, giving people control over more of the money they've earned? Now that's real stimulus. Get federal spending under control and then step aside and watch this economy roar back to life. The way forward is full of promise, but it takes more courage for a politician to step back and let the free market correct itself than it does to push through quick fixes. Reagan showed courage when he stayed the course through the long recession of the early 1980s. Critics, even in his own party, told him to abandon his tax cuts. He was confident they would work, and they did. Reagan once recalled with amusement that economists in the 1970s never saw the tech boom coming when they made their gloomy forecasts. The personal computer revolutionized our economy, yet the experts didn't see it coming. Energy independence is a bit like that. I don't think people quite see how important it is and how much it can offer us. Energy touches every aspect of our lives. It lubricates the gears of our economy. Our prosperity has been driven by steady, abundant, affordable energy supplies. In Alaska, we understand the inherent link between energy and prosperity, energy and opportunity, and energy and security. I believe Alaska will lead the nation in developing both renewable and non-renewable resources. I've always advocated an all-of-the-above approach to energy production, and I support the harnessing of alternative sources of energy, such as wind, solar, and geothermal. Using renewable sources means developing nuclear energy, too. We will achieve economic growth and energy independence if we also responsibly tap conventional resources. God created them right underfoot, beneath American soil, and under our waters. We must abandon the false dichotomy that says you can't be pro-environment and pro-development. We can responsibly develop our resources in a way that protects the environment. I speak as an Alaskan. We love our state. We live here. We raise our children here. Why would we want to foul it up? Alaskans are pro-development because we know from experience it can be done without harming the environment. No one can deny that we need crude oil. It's not just for cars. We use petroleum for everything from jet fuel to petrochemicals, plastics, fertilizers, pesticides, and pharmaceuticals. We need petroleum, and if we don't drill for it here, we must import it from developing countries that have little to no environmental protections, that often ravage the earth to extract oil, and that exploit workers with little or no regard for human rights. In denying domestic energy development, environmental groups are effectively just supporting irresponsible development overseas. Taken together, Alaska's energy reserves, coupled with future discoveries on our continent, could yield domestic energy supplies to cover America's needs for decades. Building the energy infrastructure necessary to bring these supplies to market is true economic stimulus. It means jobs. It means revenue. The bulk of America's trade deficit is fueled not just with plastic toys we buy from China, but also by the oil we import. Imagine how much stronger our economy would be if all those billions of dollars we spend overseas were circulating here in the United States. Instead, our foreign energy purchases now help subsidize regimes that don't necessarily like us and can always use energy as a weapon against us. In the end, it's not just about the environment or the economy. It's about our security and building a more peaceful world. Washington should work to clear the way for domestic energy projects that will ensure that our energy needs will never be at the mercy of madmen in possession of vast oil reserves. The way forward lies in energy independence. It will make us a more peaceful and more prosperous nation. And let's talk about peace. Today, our sons and daughters are fighting in distant countries to protect our freedoms and to nurture freedom for others. I understand that many Americans are war-weary, but we do have a responsibility to complete our missions in these countries so that we can keep our homeland safe. Our goal in the war on terror must be the same as Reagan's. We win, they lose. America must remain the strongest nation in the world in order to remain free. And our goal in the war on terror must be the same as Reagan's. We won, they lost. But military might isn't the only tool we have to guarantee peace and freedom. We are both the world's sword and its shield. We lend not just our strength, but the support of a free people to others who are fighting for their freedom. They need to know that America is not indifferent to their struggles, but will also lend her considerable diplomatic power to their cause. Nations like Israel need to be confident of our support. Some people ask whether we are still a republic or whether we are becoming an empire, doomed to fade away like all the other empires once thought to be invincible. We are still a republic. We are certainly not doomed to fade away. And we have no desire to be an empire. We don't want to colonize other countries or force our ideals on them. But we have been given a unique responsibility to show the world the meaning and the rewards of freedom. America, as Reagan said, is the abiding alternative to tyranny. We must remain the shining city on a hill to all who seek freedom and prosperity. President Obama has reminded us that our security depends in part on reaching out to other nations. I certainly agree, and I respect his leadership on this. But it is not in our best interests or the interests of the peace-loving nations of the world for America to project weakness to terrorists or tyrants. That's why I believe that the best way to avoid a fight is to be ready to fight. That sentiment is expressed in the simple yet profound motto on the sill of the USS Ronald Reagan, peace through strength. The world will not be more peaceful if we retreat behind our borders. It will, in fact, be more dangerous and violent. We don't go looking for fights, but we're ready to face them if necessary. If we ever lose faith in our ideals, the world will be a darker place for those who love peace. That's what I stand for and what I see as the way forward. The nation is at a crossroads. Will we take the path forward to a strong and prosperous future? Or will we repeat failed policies of the past? Today, millions of Americans are standing up and voicing their concerns about where our country is heading. Yet some belittle those who attend tea parties or show up at town hall meetings or dare to run for office without an establishment-approved resume. Like every other ordinary American, I'm tired of the divisions and the special interests that pit us against one another. It doesn't matter whether you grew up in Skagway or San Francisco, you're an American. Whether you're Bill Gates or Bill the Cable Guy, you're an American. Whatever your gender, race, or religion, if you love this country and will defend our Constitution, then you're an American. As I said during the campaign, all that most of us have ever asked for is a good job in our own hometown and that government be on our side and not in our way. But too many of us have felt ignored and have become disillusioned. Many Americans don't even vote because they've come to expect government to be indifferent or corrupt. I want to challenge those Americans to stand up with me. The enlightened elites want to tell you to sit down and shut up. But the way forward is to stand and fight. Throw tea parties, march on Capitol Hill, write letters to the editor, run for local office. You never know where it may lead. And make your voice heard on every single election day, on every single issue. That is your birthright. Stand now. Stand together. Stand for what is right. It is now August 2009. It was 1 year ago this week that I got the call from John McCain at the Alaska State Fair. It's very quiet in the little apartment I'm in for a couple of weeks as I work on this memoir, and the curtains are open to invite in the California sunshine. It was a bit surreal to go from a big state office and all the trappings of power to just a kitchen table, but being out of power can be very liberating. Take an example. From this tiny apartment, I watched debates unfold in Washington, and I used my Facebook page to call things like I saw them. These posts had an impact, and it made me think, isn't Facebook a terrific illustration of the power of American ingenuity? Facebook was created in a Harvard dorm room in 2004. No one gave its young creator a government grant. He just did it on his own, like generations of other American entrepreneurs. And here we have the president and his party telling us that the American system is broken and it's the government's job to fix it? What better refutation of the argument could there be than an innovation like Facebook, which sprang up out of nowhere and virtually overnight became a powerful tool for communication, commerce, and political action? As I write this, common sense conservatives are out of power in D.C., but that does not discourage me. I think of Reagan in 1976, when his conservative politics and his political future were declared all but dead. How did he turn things around in 4 years? By speaking to ordinary Americans about the ideas that bind us together. These ideas resonate just as strongly today. Encourage the free market, lower taxes, get government out of the way, put the people's money back into their hands so they can reinvest, empower them to be generous. Respect honest work, strengthen families. But because these are common sense ideas, they will be ignored by politicians until their employers, the American people, make them listen. I thought of these things as I went for a run in the California sunshine. I stopped for a minute. The green grass smelled so good, I couldn't believe all of California wasn't outside for a walk on an afternoon like this. I looked up the road and tried to see around the trees that lay ahead. The turnaround point wasn't far off, so I retied a shoelace and mentally shifted gears. Dang, I must be getting old, I mumbled. My knees creaked underneath me as I stood up again. It had been a while since I felt that stiffening and hurt you first feel when you stop in the middle of a run before picking up again. I started running again, and it wasn't long before I started feeling pretty good because I started thinking about some pretty good things. We'd been through amazing days. And really, there wasn't one thing in my life to complain about. I felt such freedom, such hope, such thankfulness for our country, a place where nothing is hopeless. Granted, I'm very concerned about our future. I question the road that Washington has us on with fundamental changes in economic policy that affect the free market and questionable shifts in national security priorities. And knowing that not many everyday Americans want to get involved in either major political party because we're just plain busy, I'm concerned that ordinary voices could be ignored. With so much going on in our lives, why would the Joe the Plumbers and the Tito the Builders want to waste time on what usually seems like a destructive exercise? Ordinary Americans feel that until both parties do some house cleaning and until government gets back on the side of the people, their time is better spent on their families and their jobs and businesses. But we must reawaken our belief in the principles that underlie our Constitution and the power we have when individuals stand together. And this does not mean an indifference to others. Far from it. We know that the most vulnerable among us deserve our protection. We value life and those who nurture it. And we want to make America a more welcoming place for those whom some may not consider perfect. History has shown us that when we empower ourselves to stand up together, we become an even more blessed and prosperous nation. And we become a more generous nation, too, a nation that has proved for more than two centuries its willingness to share its blessings with others. I believe in my soul that we will be a stronger and freer America when we walk that walk. As I ran, these thoughts accompanied my steps. The nearer I got to the turnaround point ahead, the more energy I picked up. That is where America is today, nearing the turning point. Change, real change, is just around the corner. We are picking up momentum as more and more citizens rise up and say to government, "Trust us. Trust the people of this great country. Our government is supposed to work for us. We're not supposed to work for government." Our country is definitely at a crossroads. Too many Americans no longer believe that their children will have a better future. When members of our greatest generation, the World War II generation, lose their homes and their life savings because their retirement funds were wiped out in the financial collapse, people get angry. There is a growing sentiment that says, just throw the bums out of Washington. And by that, people mean Republicans and Democrats. Everyday Americans suffering from pay cuts and job losses want to know why our elected leaders aren't tightening their own belts. I can't help but think of Michigan, the state where I went rogue trying to reach out to during the campaign. Some of the people in Michigan are hurting the most right now in our economic downturn. Michigan is a good example of why we must stand up and not give up. We must fight for reform and fight to reclaim these places suffering under the weight of decades of failed big government policies, the very policies that now threaten to overtake us all. We can't abandon Michigan and places like it. We're Americans. We don't give up on each other. I turned the corner toward my goal, and it felt so good, I didn't want to stop. I felt light and strong and joyful, with that kind of invigorating exhaustion that comes from hard work at the end of the day. I've been asked a lot lately, where are you going next? Good question. I'll be heading home to Alaska, of course. Back to that kitchen table. We'll discuss the day's news and the next stop. I always tell my kids that God doesn't drive parked cars, so we'll talk about getting on the next road and gearing up for hard work to travel down it to reach new goals. And I'm thinking when I get back, I'll bake the kids a cake and I'll pull out a road map. I want to show Piper the way to Michigan.
This recording of Going Rogue was written and read by Sarah Palin. It was produced and directed by Michael Conroy and was recorded at Mirror Studios by Charlie Hewitt. Editing, mixing, and mastering were by Lunar Sound. We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. For more information about the broad range of titles from Harper Audio, Harper Children's Audio, and Cadman, please visit our website at harperaudio.com. Thank you for listening.